This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember all those films you were shown in school that were supposed to teach you how to be a well-adapted, productive member of society with good hygiene habits and a willingness to defer to authority? How about those old industrial films designed to sell luxury cars and deluxe refrigerators? Rick Preilinger has over 25,000 educational and industrial films in his archive. Films like Are You Ready for Marriage? Girls Beware! What It Means to Be an American, and The Wonderful World of Wash and Wear. He's curated an exhibition from his archive, which runs through the end of the month at the American Museum of the Moving Image in New York. MTV, HBO, and the Comedy Channel often use his films for camp value or to help establish a period. We asked Preilinger to join us, along with his colleague Ken Smith, who's researching the history of these films for a book he's writing. Let's start with an excerpt of the 1956 film Once Upon a Honeymoon, produced for Bell Telephone to sell new color phones. A newlywed wife sings about the kitchen and living room she dreams about.
Hello, yes, this is Mary. How are you? Bye.
They say your kitchen dazzles every eye.
A brand new sink, a built-in oven, a new refrigerator and a phone, a kitchen phone, a bright red phone. I gotta go, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. I'll call you later. Wish my living room were all redone. New drapes, new rugs, oh, this is fun. It's nice to have a telephone to blend with my new drapes and rugs. A living room that's all our own.
Rick Preilinger, what are we listening to?
Once Upon a Honeymoon is a Hollywood musical, but it's only 14 minutes long, and it was made to sell color telephones to the American public back in the 50s when they first became available. But Once Upon a Honeymoon is more than just a simple sales film. It flirts with fantasy and unreality, and also we're at a time when the telephone is no longer a necessity, that it's become a decorative accessory in the home. And you know, things like whim and choice and taste enter in for the first time.
Who was supposed to watch Once Upon a Honeymoon?
Once Upon a Honeymoon, like many of the sponsored films, was made to show a little bit in theaters, but mostly to kind of captive audiences and community groups and schools. And it was also made to show on TV in the days when the networks didn't run all the time, and there were a lot of holes in the schedule. So stations begged for films that had entertainment value.
Let me play an excerpt from another film in the Preilinger archives, and this is called Shy Guy. And in this film, a teenage boy is in his basement rebuilding radios and working on his oscilloscope, and he's afraid he doesn't fit in. So his father, dressed in his business suit, comes down into the basement and gives his son advice about how to fit in at school and how to become more popular like the other boys.
You know, when we moved here this summer, I had quite a time making friends in a new office where everybody else knew each other.
What'd you do, Dad?
Well, that's beside the point, son. What works for one doesn't necessarily work for another.
But I bet the other men didn't look at your clothes all the time.
Well, what makes you think they look at your clothes?
Oh, because the other fellas wear sweaters or just shirts, not a regular suit like mine.
Well, wear a sweater then. The clothes alone won't... Phil, what about the other fellows? What do they do? What do they like?
Gosh, Dad, I don't know. I never noticed. Only I know it's not radios.
Perhaps that's the reason you don't know. You don't notice what the others are interested in. Why not try to find out?
How, Dad?
Well, you might try watching, listening. Pick out the most popular boys and girls in school and keep an eye on them. Try to figure out why people like them. Not that you'll ever be just like any of them, but you might learn something.
Now, where is this movie from?
That film was made in 1947 by Coronet Films. Coronet was one of the biggest, in fact, the biggest producer of social guidance films at that time. Social guidance films came in after World War II because parents and educators were very concerned that the kids at that time would become another lost generation as they had after World War I. So they decided to use the most modern scientific teaching tool they had available, and that was film. And so they made hundreds of social guidance films, and Shy Guy was one of the first.
This film and several other films that I've seen from your collection seem to be intent on teaching family values, teaching how you're supposed to behave with your peers and how you're supposed to behave with your family.
Well, that's very true. They were trying to teach kids how to not be adults as they had been during the war. There was again a great fear that that kids would get out of control. And Shy Guy's notable. Well, it's notable for a couple of reasons. First of all, it stars Dick York in one of his earliest appearances.
The co-star of Bewitched.
Of Bewitched, yes. And second of all, it was probably the first film that encouraged kids to look around them and try and fit in with their peers. This was a theme that ran through many of the social guidance films, and actually it kind of backfired because while adults were trying to get kids to fit in, what the kids were really doing were listening to each other instead of the adults.
And, that's an interesting point.
And then once the late 50s came around, things kind of got out of control.
Do you think the secret message of this film is conformity?
It was. It was definitely to conform was to be safe. To fit in was desirable. You didn't want to stand out. Standing out meant you were different and weird, and they didn't want that.
There's a real sense in the post-war social guidance films. I should say, by the way, that we have about 180 of them. This was a huge behavioral offensive. But there's a real sense of breeding out the unusual, of kind of normalizing interaction between people and within families and making behavior predictable.
Well, that leads me to another film in your collection, A Date with the Family. And this film is supposed to show you how a good nuclear family should handle family dinner when dad comes home from work. And the emphasis is on how family dinner can be warm and fun if everybody cooperates and participates. Why don't we hear an excerpt?
Well, the dinner date has begun, and they're all happy about it. Napkins on the lap, the family awaits service. They converse pleasantly while dad serves. I said pleasantly, for that is the keynote at dinner time. It is not only good manners, but good sense. Pleasant, unemotional conversation helps digestion. Father serves mother first, then daughter. Then the boys. Don't worry, fellas, you won't get left. By example, older children can teach younger ones good table manners. No one starts eating until father has served himself. Always wait for the hostess, in this case mother, to begin eating before you start. Let father and mother guide the conversational trend if they desire. After all, they made all this possible and may want to talk over their day with each other. Tell mother how good the food is. Maybe sis rates a compliment, too. It makes them want to continue pleasing you.
Now, when is this film from? And is this one of those social guidance films?
This is another social guidance film. It was made in 1950. Actually, it looks like it was made probably about 1930. It's this style is so stilted. It's also very typical in that the actors have nothing to say. It's completely without live sound. It's all done with a narration. And that was very typical of social guidance films. It was this kind of omnipotent voice of God. And what a child was supposed to do, you weren't supposed to think for yourself. There were just a certain set of rules. And once you memorized those rules, that's all you needed to know. Then you would fit in, and then life would run very smoothly, and you'd be very happy.
I think this film shows how much discontent must have been seething beneath the surface. Because if you had to make movies to convince people that family dinner could be fun, family dinner could be a good thing, it had to mean that a lot of people were really alienated from family dinner.
Well, you know, that film actually proposes that you lie and that you be dishonest, that you greet your dad as though you were genuinely glad to see him, as though you really missed being away from him.
Implying that you weren't genuinely glad to see him.
Right, and implying that the best family values, so to speak, are based on not speaking frankly to one another. One of the secrets which I think these films reveal is that the 50s were a time filled with discontent and paranoia, not the 50s with a warm, soft glow as it's sometimes portrayed in the media.
My guests are Rick Preylinger, who collects ephemera films in his archive, and Ken Smith, who's writing a book on these films. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rick Preylinger and Ken Smith. Rick Preylinger, how did you start collecting these films? I never would have thought that somebody was amassing these films that everybody has forgotten.
I began as a film researcher about 10 years ago, working on a project about sex and romance at mid-century. And very quickly, I discovered this whole universe of films, at first social guidance films, later on the rest of the educationals and advertising films, that nobody knew about, that were not saved anywhere. You had to maybe go to the producers, you had to go to audiovisual centers that had closed down, sometimes even dig in dumpsters. But there were still some there. And as time went on, I began to assemble a fairly large collection. You know, when you have one or two, there may be a gem and they may be particularly revealing. But when you begin to put a lot together, the big themes begin to come out and you begin to see, that there are authors and that there's voices and there's some very interesting things to see in these films.
What are some of the big themes that have emerged? And you've collected education films, social guidance films, industrials.
All of those. We also, in the last few years, have started to collect amateur movies, home movies, because they're tremendously revealing about everyday life, the look of people and places. One of the themes which I think is most interesting is kind of the grooming of the perfect American consumer over time. The American consumer was constructed by some major corporations over time, and there's a lot of revealing evidence about how this was done in the films, how desire was created, how model buyers and model families were presented for us to emulate.
A lot of these movies precede television advertising.
That's correct, and in fact, early TV commercials took a great deal of their stylistic inspiration from some of the old one-minute movies that used to show in movie theaters.
So when companies made industrials advertising their new products and showing what you were supposed to want next, who would they show it to?
There was, until recently, a fairly well-established circuit for showing sponsored films around the country. And it was an incredibly inexpensive means of reaching the public with a message that didn't last 30 seconds or 1 minute, but maybe 10 minutes or half an hour. Films like We Drivers, a safety film made by GM with a little bit of advertising in it, were seen by over 30 million people.
Where did they see them?
In the old days, they were shown in theaters, especially the newsreel theaters that used to clutter up downtown areas. They're gone now. In schools, in 4-H groups, granges, on shipboard, in prisons, women's groups.
Rick, when you decided you were going to start collecting these films, where did you go to get more of them? And were people willing to give them to you?
I was surprised that many of these films still existed. Conventional film archives have devoted their attention to preserving threatened masterworks, nitrate feature films, let's say, and to a limited extent, newsreels. But there was no archive to go through for these. A lot of the people who had worked in some of the production companies had felt that these films were too valuable to throw away. They didn't know why they were saving them, but they were very pleased that I was interested in bringing them into an archive. Some of them came from colleges and high schools who had gotten rid of film and shifted over to video and had closets full of films that were declared surplus. And then I guess maybe the most interesting source is from, you know, this is a nation of pack rats. People don't like to throw things away if they have any room, and sometimes even if they don't. And quite often people will have films in their attics or their basements, and they perceive that they're of some value, but they don't really know what to do with them. And, you know, oftentimes we're lucky to hear from those people.
Have you found a lot of producers, directors, actors who made industrials in the early part of their career and then became better known for Hollywood or television work?
Yes. As a matter of, well, of course, we've already mentioned Dick York and Shy Guy, the man who narrated that film His name is Myron Walashinsky, and of course we know him better now by his new name, which is Mike Wallace.
Are you kidding?
That's where he got his start. We're showing a film in our series called Freedom Highway, which was the first film that Angie Dickinson was ever in.
Wow.
So yes, it was a stepping stone for quite a few people because there were so many of these films made. Hundreds of thousands of these kinds of films were made. And any actor or narrator who wanted to support himself or herself, you know, did these films just to feed themselves.
I was also going to mention that Robert Altman got his start as a director at Calvin in Kansas City, and he made one film which we have, which is astonishing, called The Magic Bond for VFW, which has a scene in it of G.I. sitting around in a foxhole, and it looks just like MASH.
Some of the films in your archive seem to be odes to the factory assembly line or exhortations to workers to get out there and work with good spirit and be productive. They almost remind me of what I think of as, like, you know, communist propaganda films, but instead of being about communism, they're about capitalism.
Well, I think that's very true. I call some of these films examples of capitalist realism because, in fact, the techniques of the Soviet cinema are being used to promote the American system here. From Dawn to Sunset, which is a film made in 1937, was made by General Motors right after the United Auto Workers successfully organized the first plants in Flint and around Detroit. And in a way, it's an attempt to deny that unions exist, because what it does is it shows a kind of circular relationship between workers and the company for whom they work. Workers become consumers rather than, dare I say, a class with any interests of their own. And it's by omission, I think is trying to imply that unions are an unnecessary force.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of From Dawn to Sunset?
Follow the eastern sun as it rises on the homes of men along the great Atlantic seaboard. The morning light over the plains has waked the thousands who are off to enliven the factories of the vast Midwestern states. And along the sunny shores of the Pacific, men are on their way to quicken the beat of industry. In 12 great cities, located in every region of the country, the clans are gathering for the work of a new day. As the sun stretches fingers of light across the pavements, the early morning sparkles with the greeting of men to men. On their way to factories in Flint and Atlanta, from Tarrytown to Oakland, the neighborly workmen hail each other with the salute of fellowship.
Do you think of this as a propaganda film?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. It was thrown together out of a lot of stock footage just months after the first union contract was signed. One of these days, you know, the background of a lot of these films is fascinating, and nobody's really done the historical research, you know, to try to go back to corporate records and see if there's memos or information about this. But I think that we'll find that it's a propaganda response on GM's part.
Do you each have any personal favorites in the thousands of films in the Prelinger archives?
Well, my favorite social guidance film is probably, I think, everybody else's favorite, which is a film called Dating Do's and Don'ts. It was a film made by Cornette in 1949, and it basically takes you through a date step by step, presenting you with various alternatives as to the way you want to act. I mean, at the end, you know, Woody, who is the lead, he has the option of either lunging for the woman who he's saying goodnight to or shaking her hand. And of course, when he lunges, he's spurned, and when he shakes her hand, he is congratulated and walks off at the end whistling very happily.
Rick, what about you?
Well, I was sitting trying to think of a specific film, and I can't. I guess what I would say is I'm most fond of the films which seem to have some kind of inconsistency in them, where what you see is not the same as what you hear. For example, in Dawn to Sunset, which we were talking about, you hear about how these workers are happy and earning money and living the good life, but you see, you know, the demeaning and the dangerous nature of the work that they're doing. So you're really forced to kind of resolve that discontinuity in your mind.
Have you come across any of the movies that you actually remember from your youth? Have you come across them in the collection?
I found a good many, actually. I mean, I remember the one on artificial respiration where people
yeah.
People run to the pool to revive the the kid. And, of course, I remember the wonderful Frank Capra science films, like Our Mr. Sun and Hemo the Magnificent.
Oh, I remember Hemo the Magnificent.
Yeah, sure. Ken just turned those up in the shelves the other day.
we keep
finding stuff. It's out of this collection, I've seen perhaps 2,000 films. Ken's maybe seen another couple thousand.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, 18,000 more, 20,000 more to look at.
You could probably watch these films for the rest of your life and not watch your whole collection.
It's a life sentence, I suppose.
It is indeed.
But it beats working, and your sense of history begins to, it's constantly reworking and rewriting itself.
But it's so interesting because you're looking at a phony presentation of life that is actually very revealing about what real life was.
Well, historians have often been caught up in kind of a trap of authenticity. If it isn't, an exact record of a real historical event, it isn't important. And I would argue, on the contrary, that these films are all about what we received from the top down, how the media sent messages to people, how we were conditioned, trained, taught, and sold to, and what our aspirations and our feelings were over time. And I think that that's very important, because the history of the 20th century is to a great extent the history of the mass media. In addition, these films are also very interesting because they do picture life as it was. You can see the look of a street.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see average and ordinary families, and you can see, very rich visual imagery that contains a lot of information. You wouldn't see it in a feature film that was more stylized. You wouldn't see it in a newsreel or an old TV show.
It's very true. The as strange as these films may look to us now, and as stilted and as unreal, the producers made a very conscious effort to reproduce reality as closely as they could, in order to make the messages of the film more acceptable. So while we may look at them and shake our heads in disbelief, at the time they were considered much more real than anything, of course, that Hollywood was producing.
Right. Well, I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Rick Preilinger is the founder of the Preilinger Archives. His colleague Ken Smith is writing a book about ephemera films. Preilinger curated an exhibition of films from his archive. The show runs through the end of January at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.